Accession number 13460, reel 4.
This is Peter Bouguet, continued at reel 2.
It was a fantastic flight. We'd been shorter distances, like Africa, South Africa, and so on tropical trials. But this trip to Australia was a pure and simple demonstration and a record attempt. And we did it. I don't remember exact details. My main memory is having four breakfasts on the way, bacon, eggs every stop, and the reception we got in Sydney was absolutely out of this world. They were much more friendly towards the English than they seem to be now, and they were literally thousands of people on the airfield, and they all came right, absolutely streaming right up to the Comet as we stopped. We tried to shut the engine, the switch off. We couldn't get out of the airplane for an hour or so until after we landed. We got pictures of proud fathers holding the babies up to the air intakes to look in, and really perilous sort of thing. It's quite out of control, but it was marvelous.
And you said that your record is still in existence, is it?
We did it in just under 24 hours elapsed time. I don't think you can do better than that on any. It's not the record still. Obviously, somebody's bettered the record. But you can't do it better in any commercial airline at the moment, I don't think.
Could you tell me something about the Trident now?
Yes. Of course, everybody thought Trident was going to be the salvation after having failed to sell the number of Comets. We thought we were still ahead of the Americans in the construction of the Trident. Three-engine aeroplane was a brand new thing. Four were too many, two not enough, so it had to be three. It was a very logical development. And Trident was a very modern aeroplane in every way. It had everything triplicated. There's no way anything could go wrong at all. So many safeguards built in right from the start. We had learned an awful lot of things from the Comet, and things like full hydraulic control. Most pilots are terribly suspicious of flying controls without any actual physical feel in them. Of course, there isn't any feel, it's all artificial.
As opposed to cable controls.
Yes. I was a bit too advanced at that time. Even in the Comet, I said, we can do it now. Why on earth do we have to pamper to all these very senior, very ancient airline pilots who insist on having a huge gate stick and hold back on it? We can do it with a matchstick. It can serve exactly the same purpose, and it's no problem. We have the capability of doing that. But there's no way I could get that over to anybody. No, you had to have this great thing. The heavier, the more you pulled. People didn't think you can develop enough sensitivity in your two fingers. Well, it's ridiculous, of course. And any modern fighter pilot has it now. Even the Airbus has it now. We could have done it then. But There was one time I got so exasperated. I said, you should shoot every senior pilot in the world, except a couple of us back at Hatfield. Let us start afresh. Because it's very difficult. When you have to introduce a new aeroplane to pilots, you have to make use of their experience. If it goes against what they're used to, they're not safe. And if you try to educate 20-year-old, which we could have done, they wouldn't have the experience to carry off a flight across the world. You have to have some experience for that. But with this experience, you get all the bad experience as well. There's no way we could get over that. It would take a generation, which is what it has now. It's no good trying to be too quick.
But you still had your power controls.
Oh, yes, we had power control. We won that battle in the end with no reversion to manual, which a lot of people insisted on in the Comet. And we just managed to get out of that on the Trident. There was no question of it, of course. It was all purely power controls. And it worked very well. Even so, you can put exactly what you want into it. We still have a very controversial stick which went this way.
The ram's horn.
Ram's horns. I didn't like that at all. But I was talked out of any opposition to it by people who thought I knew better. It takes an awful lot of time to get used to. It's the most unnatural. With that, you fly on your stomach muscles, because moving something very heavily from side to side, there is no natural resistance. If you do it one way against another, you balance the two arms together. Or pushing and pulling, you can balance your with your whole body. This sideways motion, I never got to like that.
So they had it on the 125 as well, didn't they?
Yes.
And the Concorde?
No, I don't think quite the same. No.
They rotated, did they? Mm. Anyway,
The first flight on the Trident, of course, was an absolute classic. It takes an awful long time to get as far as the first flight. Take weeks and weeks building up. The runs down the runway, checking the brakes, checking the tires, checking everything. And then you just do a rocking to see that everything functions the right way around. And then the great moment comes when you actually take off. The takeoff was absolutely perfect. We got off the ground and got up and did the normal functions, which you always do first of all. Check undercarriage, up and down, flaps, everything, timing and so on. Everything works in the right direction, in the right order. So it happened that we hadn't quite followed Murphy's law on the undercarriage. Something did go wrong. And we had very, very clever arrangement on the undercarriage. It was a very big undercarriage, very unusual undercarriage, which had to turn sideways as it got down. And the hole it left in the wing when it was down was enormous, so it would have affected the lift coming in at low speed. And so we had doors closing these. And we had something wonderful word called a sequencing valve, which directed all the hydraulic pressures at the right time to the right places. Now this one went wrong, and it directed the landing gear leg up as it directed the door, wing closing door, down. So they met together, and they got stuck. Absolutely stuck. We just take it up or down, there were two forces acting together. So there was stuck. One gear halfway up, and the other one fully down. It was the worst possible way you can have an aeroplane. And especially on the very first flight, you don't know how it's going to work. A brand new undercarriage in a configuration nobody had ever tried before. Four wheels in tandem. Oh, and a square on one side.
Yeah.
So they were stuck. And of course, we'd been very confident. We had a full press corps in flying control. So we didn't want to go too public on this. We got our chief hydraulic engineer up in the tower as well, told him. And he said, it's impossible. It's impossible. It couldn't happen. So I said, fortunately, we have photographic proof, because we had a Meteor and a Canberra, it's a photographic chase airplanes, and they had taken hundreds of pictures of this. So we'll show you when we get down, if we get down in one piece. Meanwhile, what do we do? He had no answer at all. And it was our flight engineer came up with the answer in the end. And I said, if you trim the airplane, fly nice and steady, we found the airplane is quite stable, level flight. You can switch off all the controls, all the hydraulics, dump all the hydraulic pressure, which means you have no flying control, and no undercarriage control, flap control, anything. So things will just fall down naturally. And so we did, and the thing flew very smoothly and steadily, only for half a minute or so. And we had this man by the cockpit door, somebody holding onto his ankles when he had his head outside looking at the undercarriage, and said, yes, we had to do that. We couldn't see the undercarriage from the cockpit.
Did you chase aircraft, wouldn't you tell
him? Yes, but we wanted to make sure ourselves. Anyway. And so there it was. And so we left it at that, put the pressure back on again, in which case it stayed down, everything was all right. But as our engineer said, it could not have happened. But it did. Anyway, that was it. And from then on, we didn't have any problems, except with the thing didn't perform quite the way it should because of the specification, which we had to follow because of BEA. It wasn't quite as lively as we thought it should have been. It's good enough for BEA, perfect for them, absolutely adequate. People with enormous runways, wherever they went, it couldn't be better. But it wasn't a very economical aeroplane for anyone else. But Because it needed a long runway to take off. And of course we had to, we got it modified in the end. The 1Es and 1Fs and so on, they had modified droop leading edges, and so had better takeoff performance, so we could sell those to a few other people. Not a lot, because, again, the Americans had overtaken us with the 727, and they were in the business of making 100 airplanes while we made one. So there's no way we could compete with them on that.
But sure, was the wing then not versatile enough?
I mean, it was, but we hadn't developed it. We had developed it for BEA. The wing is a marvelous wing, beautiful wing, and it's still to this day a very good aerodynamic wing, I think. We learned from that wing what we learned from that wing has gone into the wing of the Airbus, for instance. So it was a first-class top-performance wing, but not the way that BEA had it.
But didn't the ordinary ones, didn't they have leading-edge troops?
Yes, but nothing like as much as we had later, as good as we had later. They were very simple and just stayed down. The later ones came out and down and made it a very complicated wing shape. And the flaps, enormous flaps, again, very complicated shapes.
But it was designed also to lose height very rapidly. I mean, you could use reverse thrust in flight.
Yes, we did that, yes. Yes.
I mean, one BEA captain told me that the VSI often went off the clock coming down.
Oh, yes.
Over 9,000 feet a minute.
Yeah. Oh, indeed, yes. Mm.
That was quite exciting. Was designed for operating in a very crowded airspace, then, wasn't it?
Yes, and well, this was mainly because of requirement for getting down from altitude in case of failure.
It wasn't a commercial requirement?
Yes.
Not a commercial?
No, not a commercial.
An emergency requirement?
Yes, it was. Mainly that. Then, of course, we had quite a lot of trouble with the superstall on this. It was the first aeroplane that really had a superstall. We thought it had. Nobody could be quite certain of it because nobody had ever actually tried it. But from the configuration, we could see that it could, in theory, get into that sort of position. And so we got as near as we possibly could. Again, I did most of the stalls on it. And I got into one very, very near superstall. I lost a good 10,000 feet on it. And just got out in the skin of my teeth. Hard work my stomach muscles. This awkward thing.
How? Were you waggling the wings?
Yes. And I was trying to get the thing. It went. It did like a falling leaf, which I had done before in a tiger moth, but never in a big aeroplane. Very uncomfortable.
And you managed to restart the engines?
Oh, the engines didn't stop. Fortunately, they kept going.
But you couldn't get enough power to get you out of it?
No, no. The angle of incidence was such that we were in a stall, and there was no lift on the wing, and the tail was getting ineffective because it was in the slipstream on the wing. So that was a big problem. We got over that in the end by various devices, like we had a stick pusher, which pushed the stick forward. Got it out of your grip, in fact, and when you got up to a certain angle, it was very effective. And as long as you used it, we had one pilot ignored it and crashed his aeroplane.
Or George, isn't it? George Errington?
Yeah, he wasn't a pilot. He was not a Trident pilot. He was used by one of our newer pilots, who was a Navy pilot, Peter Barlow. He did things. He was a very, very awkward character indeed, and he didn't believe. He thought he was God's gift to aviation, which he certainly was not. And I told him very carefully, do not go into this area. But he was doing production test flying, and he got people like George Errington, who shouldn't have been in that aeroplane at all, because he didn't know anything about it. But this chap didn't like flying with any of us, because we might have told him to do otherwise. And I have a suspicion that he was going to show George Errington how good he was at the stall. And of course he got into a superstall, and just spiraled down gently.
And they both died?
Everybody on board, yes.
Terrible.
Yes. It should never happen. But that was directly ignoring instructions, which is a very bad deal. I mean, it was not a mistake. And not a... he didn't go into it in ignorance. He just thought it was too clever.
And he had a stick pusher or not?
Yes, we switched it off.
Oh, he switched it
off. Yes. Well, you can do that on test flights. You can do that. Just remove the circuit breaker and everything goes. Stick shaker. First we had a stick shaker shaking the thing violently when you got near it, and if it persisted you had a stick pusher which really pushed it very hard.
Get out of your hands.
Yes. And I suggested that after that we should get some of the God Save the Queen. I didn't quite get that in.
Were you around when they lost that Trident at Heathrow? Were you in on the investigation of that one?
Now, what happened to that?
Well, they suspect it was a superstall. It was in passenger service. And I believe the pilot had a heart attack.
Oh, that's right, yes. Yes.
Were you in on the...
No, I wasn't on the investigation of that. I don't quite know why not. I did practically all the investigations on the Comet and on the Trident. Well, we didn't have all that many fatal things on the Trident. I just had to teach people how to fly them, which was quite interesting.
That was a difficult job?
It started off by being almost impossible. Point was, we could only sell this thing to third world airlines, like Iraq Airways and Pakistanis. Naturally, Pakistanis weren't too bad. Iraqis, they were, that's a hopeless lot. Some of them are brilliant pilots, and some of them shouldn't ever been in any airplane at all. Same all over that part, same with Egyptians teaching them to fly Comets. And teaching people to fly under those circumstances is not very rewarding, because in all these airlines there's somebody there who doesn't want to take any responsibility at all, and they say, it's up to you. And I said, you give me the pilot, I'll train them, and it's up to you to select the pilots. And they go on like that. And if anything goes wrong, it's my fault. They make quite certain that they can never be blamed for anything. So it's not easy. And if you tell them somebody is not fit to do the job, say, oh, give him another chance. He's a nephew of a Minister of Interior. You know? You must give him another chance. I said, I don't care a fuck whether it's Navy or anybody. It's no good as a pilot. Oh, you must give him another chance. I said, okay, I'll give him another 10 hours. If you pay for it, it's your money and your airplane, but I can't guarantee anything. And then after 10 hours, I said, I will not do any more with this pilot. If after I leave, you decide to go on, that's your problem. I don't want to waste my time on him. That's the sort of thing that happens all the time with that sort of airline. It wouldn't happen in a European airline because they have much more discipline, and the average is much better. They have a certain average before they get to flying the best airplanes. Well, that doesn't happen. Argentina. And across the place would be impossible. Not just flying. Yes, they did. Oh, yes.
On the Argentinians?
Yes. Oh, yes, two.
They lost two.
Yes, I investigated one of them. One was so simple it didn't need investigation. They had two pilots. I knew them both. I trained one of them, and the other one was a co-pilot. So I'd met, but I hadn't trained. The captain was a very good pilot. But it so happened on this occasion they teamed up wrongly. Their teaming had gone entirely wrong, because you've got to be very careful with that in South America. There are people whose family haven't spoken to each other for hundreds of years. If they happen to be in an airline, if the co-pilot and the captain are on two opposite families, you have problems. This happened in this instant, and the co-pilot was they had a certain way of approaching at night, not very many aides, and it wasn't easy in a Comet, because it was in the early days, and the attitude was such that it's very difficult to judge whether you're going flat or descending or going uphill. And the pilot had his eye on the landing strip, the lights in front of him, which can be very deceptive. The co-pilot is supposed to read out the altimeter every 100 feet. Now, if you have a co-pilot who doesn't speak as a captain, that doesn't work. The captain was killed in this accident. Nobody else did. The co-pilot was alive. We asked if he had done the correct procedure. He said, no, I don't speak to the captain.
Should never have been rostered together.
No, of course not. But that again was a lack of discipline. No, somebody didn't do the right thing. And that happened all the time. I was called in. I'd been with them for half a year before teaching them. This was or maybe a year after, and I was called in to give them all a check, all the pilots, because I thought they were getting bad habits. So I said, I know your pilots. Most of them very good pilots. If I'm with them, they'll do the right thing. It's quite pointless me doing this. It's up to you to ensure that you have the discipline. I fly around with them, and I suspect that I'll only confirm that they're doing the right thing when I'm there. And so they did. But that's no way to run an airline. I'm getting very cynical about it now. I recognize I spent a whole working life flying airplanes. And it was great fun. And in the war, I wouldn't have done anything else. I did a job that had to be done. After that, it was just fun for me, personally. Sometimes I wonder what good I've served the world, and the answer is none whatever. I remember early on in the Comet, I asked somebody in the Havilland, who wants these airplanes? Is it the airlines? Is it the flying public? Or is it just you who've got to make a profit? And I was told, shut up. Don't bother your head about that sort of thing. Just fly the darn thing. And I've always wondered who it is who wants them. Because if you start off with DC-6s, they're comfortable airplanes, slow. They get you there. And so somebody can make a faster airplane, so it will be made. It's like going to the moon, climbing Everest. It's there. It's got to be done. But it hasn't got mankind any further, has it? I haven't served a good purpose in the world from that point of view. I think it's been a bit of a waste. I've enjoyed it, but that's just...
More people have travelled, but whether what it's got them...
Look at the Costa Brava. I don't think that's a great advance.